We have reached the final lesson in our series on Elijah and Elisha. And in the last lesson, we looked at the miracles that Elisha performed in 2 Kings chapters 4 through 6. We noticed how he made the blind to see, he made the lepers cleansed, he made the dead raised, and the poor had good news preached to them. And then in 2 Kings 6, in verse 23, we noticed how he brought peace between Israel and Syria in a rather unconventional way. And it says there that the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. But that peace doesn't last. And today we will pick up right where we left off in 2 Kings chapter 6. So if you'd like to follow along in your Bibles, you can open to 2 Kings 6. We'll begin reading here in verse 24. It says, "Afterward, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, mustered his entire army and went up and besieged Samaria." Now, previously, Syria had been using different tactics in their warfare against Israel. They had been trying to lay ambushes and to capture or kill the king of Israel. And remember, their intelligence was always being betrayed, and it was found out that it was Elisha who knew what they were doing ahead of time, and he could warn the king of Israel about these ambush attacks. We just read in verse 23 about how they had been previously going on raids to the land of Israel, where they would go and attack and then kind of retreat, but they stopped doing that for a while. And now Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, decides to try something else, something extreme. He takes his entire army and lays siege to the capital city of Israel, the capital city of Samaria. And a siege was an all-out kind of effort. They would surround the city, and instead of fighting directly, they would keep anybody from coming in or going out. The object of a siege was to break the will of your enemy. If there's no supplies coming in, if there's no way to go out, little by little, conditions get worse and worse inside the city until they're so bad that the enemy will buckle to your will. That's the idea. And so Syria has Samaria in siege with the goal to make them buckle to their will. And the situation gets very desperate very fast. In verse 25, it says, "There was a great famine in Samaria as they besieged it, until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver and the fourth part of a cab of dove's dung for 5 shekels of silver." Okay, I know that we're dealing with inflation these days. I know that when you go to the grocery store, it's a little surprising how little you get for your money sometimes. It's not this bad. I don't know exactly what the conversion rate is for 84 shekels of silver, but whatever it is, that's a lot of money to pay for roasted donkey head with a side of bird poop. But that's what they're eating. That's how bad things are. Conditions are bad in Samaria because of this siege. And besides the fact that this kind of food would be considered unclean under Jewish law, it would just be considered disgusting under normal circumstances. Nobody would eat these things. Nobody would value these things at all unless they were very, very desperate. And so these are not normal circumstances. These are desperate times. Because food is so scarce, because the people are so hungry, there's extraordinarily high demand for things that are barely edible. And yet, this is nothing compared to what happens next. In verse 26, "Now, as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, saying, 'Help, my lord, O king.' And he said, 'If the Lord will not help you, how shall I help you? From the threshing floor or from the winepress?' And the king asked her, "What is your trouble?" She answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we boiled my son and ate him. And on the next day, I said to her, 'Give me your son that we may eat him.' But she has hidden her son." When the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now he was passing by on the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath on his body. Now I'll tell you what, that's hard to read. It's hard to imagine. You know, these stories that we read in the Bible are real stories of real people. And this is the real condition that they were living in under this siege. Even the king seems horrified by how bad things have gotten inside of the city. Notice that at first he spouts off with some sarcasm about, "Well, I don't know what you want me to do." But when he finds out what this woman is arguing about, or what these two women are arguing about, he doesn't even reply. He doesn't have anything to say. He just tears his clothes. And I think that in this moment, the king realizes just how awful conditions have gotten inside of the city that he rules. These people are paying outrageous prices for things that are barely edible. Mothers are arguing in the streets over eating each other's children. It's hard to imagine conditions being that bad. It's not much of an overstatement to say that this city has become a type of hell on earth. So the king is just outraged about this. He could use a dose of Solomon's wisdom in a situation like this, but he doesn't seem to be able to find it. He decides that he's going to have to blame somebody, and so he blames Elisha. Look at this in verse 31. He said, "May God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today." He sounds a lot like his mother Jezebel did in 1 Kings 19, vowing to take the life of Elijah during a time of famine. But here, this king vows to take the life of Elisha. He says, by the end of the day, Elisha will pay for how bad things are in this place. Now here's what happens next. In verse 32, it says, Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. Now the king had dispatched a man from his presence, but before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, "Do you see how this murderer has sent to take off my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door and hold the door fast against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him?" And while he was still speaking with them, the messenger came down to him and said, "This trouble is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?" So Elisha seems to know that the messenger is on his way. I don't know if that's by supernatural means, or that he just has some inkling that trouble is coming. But he knows that when that messenger arrives, that he will come with his death sentence. And so Elisha is talking to the elders who he is sitting with, and he's explaining to them the situation. And while he's speaking, the messenger arrives. He says, "I know why Samaria is in such bad shape. I know where this siege from Syria is actually coming from. This is the work of the Lord. And because you are the man of God, you're the one that's going to take the blame for this." But look at what Elisha says in chapter 7 in verse 1. Elisha said, "Hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time, a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." In other words, Elisha says, within 24 hours, by this time tomorrow, the markets will adjust to an overabundance of supply. This hyperinflation is going to just be gone. There's going to be so much food that prices will return to very, very affordable levels. But then he says this in verse 2. The captain actually speaks first. It says, "The captain on whose hand the king leaned said to the man of God, 'If the Lord himself should make windows in heaven, could this thing be?' But he said, 'You shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it.'" So this sounds too good to be true to the captain. This messenger who comes from the king, the one that was an agent of the king's will, he comes to bring this aggression against Elisha, and when Elisha predicts that this problem will soon go away, he says, "This is too good to be true. If God was to open up windows in heaven, could this actually take place?" And Elisha makes a prediction that we'll see come true by the end of chapter 7. That the captain will see with his own eyes the word of the Lord fulfilled, and yet he will not partake in the blessings of it. And so, starting in verse 3, we have a scene change. Continuing on in 2 Kings 7 in verse 3, it says, "Now there were four men who were lepers at the entrance to the gate. And they said to one another, 'Why are we sitting here until we die? If we say, let us enter the city, the famine is in the city, and we shall die there. And if we sit here, we die also. So now come, let us go over to the camp of the Syrians. If they spare our lives, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall but die.'" Don't you just love the leper's logic here? It's beautiful for its simplicity, really. Now, we talked about leprosy a little bit in the last lesson as we discussed Naaman's situation in 2 Kings chapter 4. Leprosy in the Bible can refer to a number of different health conditions, skin conditions, and infections. And in some cases, it could be very, very bad. It could be very painful. It could disfigure your appearance. In extreme cases, you could lose your fingers or your nose. So it would create lots of suffering. But the worst part of leprosy, really, was that it was a social death sentence. People who were lepers were not allowed to intermingle with the general population. The old law specified how they had to live outside the camp and even warn people as they came across them, covering their mouths and shouting, "Unclean, unclean." And so these four lepers are sitting at about the only place that they're allowed to sit at this time. They're sitting at the entrance of the gate of the city. Society is breaking down inside the city. The enemy is waiting for them outside the city. And so here they are sitting right on the line where it seems like they've got death on both sides. Caught between a rock and a hard place, right? But then one leper says to another, "All right, hear me out. I know this sounds crazy, but what if instead of just sitting here, we went to the camp of the enemy? If we go into the city, we'll definitely die. If we keep sitting here, we'll definitely die. If we go to the camp of the enemy, we'll probably die. But that's better than definitely." And that's all the hope they need. Just a sliver of hope is enough for them to say, "You know what? Probably dying is better than definitely dying." And in verse 5, it says, "They arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Syrians. But when they came to the edge of the camp of the Syrians, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, 'Behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to come against us.' So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents, their horses, and their donkeys, leaving the camp as it was, and fled for their lives. And when the lepers came to the edge of the camp, they went into a tent and ate and drank, and they carried off silver and gold and clothing and went and hid them. Then they went back and entered another tent and carried off things from it and went and hid them. I think that worked out better than any of the lepers could have expected that it would. Instead of being able to convince the king of Syria to somehow show them mercy, when they show up to the camp of the Syrians, it's totally abandoned. Overnight, the Lord had taken care of this Syrian threat, but at this point, nobody had realized it yet. The lepers are the ones who discover it. And so when they come to the camp of the Syrians, they find it totally abandoned. The Syrian army had heard horses and chariots during the night. And they assumed that the king of Israel had hired the Hittites and the Egyptians to come and bail him out of this pickle that he was in. But it was God who made them hear that sound. I wonder if God employed those same fiery horses and chariots that we've seen him employ twice so far. Once to take Elijah up into heaven, and then once on the hillside to show to Elisha's servant Gehazi. But God made the Syrian forces hear horses and chariots. They went running off into the sunrise, in the twilight, leaving their tents, their horses, their donkeys, and their camp right where it was. And so when the lepers show up, they find more wealth than they ever dared to imagine that they would. And it's theirs for the taking. So they go in, they make themselves at home, they sit in the tents, they eat, they drink, they take silver, they take gold, they go and they stash it somewhere for later, but then they come back and they do it all over again until one of the lepers has a little pull at his conscience. In verse 9, then they said to one another, "We are not doing right. This day is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now, therefore, come, let us go and tell the king's household." So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, "We came to the camp of the Syrians, and behold, there was no one to be seen or heard there, nothing but the horses tied and the donkeys tied and the tents as they were." Then the gatekeepers called out, and it was told within the king's household. And the king rose in the night and said to his servants, "I will tell you what the Syrians have done to us. They know that we are hungry. Therefore, they have gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the open country, thinking, 'When they come out of the city, we shall take them alive and get into the city.'" And one of his servants said, "Let some men take 5 of the remaining horses, seeing that those who are left here will fare like the whole multitude of Israel who have already perished. Let us send and see." So they took 2 horsemen. And the king sent after them, after the army of the Syrians, saying, "Go and see." So they went after them as far as the Jordan, and behold, all the way was littered with garments and equipment that the Syrians had thrown away in their haste. And the messengers returned and told the king. Now, I don't know which of the 4 lepers had the idea that they needed to reconsider what they were doing. I wonder if it was the same one, or I wonder if it was maybe a different one who had the original idea to go. But somebody, in all of the hoarding of all of this resources, between bites of, you know, bread and ham or whatever they're eating, not ham, that wouldn't be clean, lamb, you know, whatever. But between bites of food, he says, "We can't just keep enjoying this for ourselves." Do you guys remember how bad things were in Samaria? There were people eating their babies in there. "We can't just keep this to ourselves. We have to tell them what we found." And so they go to the gatekeepers, and the word gets back to the king. And at first, he thinks that it must be a trap, but he's convinced to send out some scouts, and lo and behold, those scouts come back with good news. The Syrians' camp has been abandoned, and all of their goods are there for the taking. Well, in verse 16, it says, "Then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Syrians. So a seah of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord." Now, the king had appointed the captain on whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate, and the people trampled him in the gate so that he died, as the man of God had said when the king came down to him. For when the man of God had said to the king, 2 seahs of barley shall be sold for a shekel, and 1 seah of fine flour for a shekel, about this time tomorrow in the gate of Samaria, the captain had answered the man of God, "If the Lord himself should make windows in heaven, could such a thing be?" And he had said, "You shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it." And so it happened to him, for the people trampled him in the gate, and he died. So it turns out that this day of good news was not good news for everyone. In all of the excitement, the captain is trampled, and verses 1 and 2 are fulfilled. He sees the Lord's provisions, but he is not able to eat of them. So what are we supposed to see in this story for us? Well, first, I would like for you to think about the state of the city laying under siege. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, in verse 26, Paul talks about people who have been ensnared by the devil, people who have been captured by him to do his will. I think the city of Samaria gives us a very dramatic picture of what it looks like when the devil lays siege to a person's heart. Just like the Syrians laid siege to the city of Samaria, Satan would love to lay siege to your heart. He wants to keep anything good from coming in or going out. And when that happens, you begin to buckle to his will. Your life becomes a type of hell on earth. Just like the people in the city were paying outrageous prices for things that weren't even worth very much, you will too. When you're spiritually starving, you get desperate. You know, Jesus talked about this in the Sermon on the Mount. He said in Matthew 6 and verse 19, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal." Common sense should tell us that earthly possessions are really not all that valuable. They're temporary, they're passing away, they're decaying. Money, possessions, status, pleasure, acceptance, those things are not really valuable. But if you don't have treasure in heaven, if that's all you have, then you'll pay whatever it costs to get it. You'll pay outrageous prices for things that ultimately are really not very valuable at all. When Satan lays siege to your heart, starvation will push you to disgusting extremes. You'll sacrifice a lot to get earthly treasures. Spiritual starvation can even push you to cannibalism. Remember how terrible it was when we saw those 2 women in Samaria who were arguing over eating each other's babies? It's spiritual starvation that makes us fight with some people and devour others. When you are desperate to satisfy your own belly, when you are wrapped up in the self-centeredness and the selfishness that comes with spiritual starvation, then everybody around you is either a threat or an object. You can't really have loving relationships where you serve others. Everybody around you is either a threat or an object. And so that creates all kinds of problems. It creates problems in families. Parents may try to live vicariously through their children, instead of really having their best interest at heart. Or they might just neglect them and not give them the attention that they need. This can create problems in marriages. When husbands and wives are more focused on what they get from one another instead of what they can do for one another, then that creates a very self-centered, selfish relationship. And then if either the husband or the wife feels like they're not really getting what they think that they need to get, then they're tempted to look elsewhere. This creates problems in the workplace. This creates problems in friendships. Spiritually starving people act selfishly. And selfishness erodes every relationship that we have. The longer that you live under siege to the devil, the more miserable your life becomes. C.S. Lewis wrote in The Great Divorce something that I think is very insightful. He wrote, "Hell begins with a grumbling mood, always complaining, always blaming others, but you are still distinct from it. You may even criticize it in yourself and wish you could stop it, but there may come a day when you can no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood or even to enjoy it, but just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine. It is not a question of God sending us to hell. In each of us there is something growing which will be hell unless it is nipped in the bud." I think there's a lot of truth to that. And to be honest with you, that's something that I need to hear. That grumbling mood, that complaining, that tendency to blame others, there is the misery of hell bound up in that. When Satan gets a hold of our hearts, that's the kind of outcome that it produces. Those who continue in slavery to sin will ultimately experience an eternal hell, final separation from the goodness of God. But before that, many will experience a type of hell on earth. And if that's your experience, if you've seen the effects of Satan laying siege to your heart, causing you to overvalue things that really shouldn't be as valuable, or causing you to act selfishly and erode your relationships, it should motivate you to want to make a change. It should make you think, there's got to be something better than this. And even if you don't know what you'll find, you ought to have the courage that the lepers had to go and see. Those lepers came to their senses and they escaped from the snare of Syria after being captured. They were able to find greater blessings than they ever dared to imagine. They were sitting at the gates of the city, right on the line between the inside and the outside, and they realized that they had a choice to make. Going into the city meant certain death. Living under siege was a miserable way to live, with an awful end. But leaving the city was venturing into the unknown. They didn't know what to expect, but when they did, they found their captors had already been defeated by the power of God. And Jesus actually talked about his own power over Satan like that too. In Luke chapter 11, Jesus was casting out demons. And there were some people who were accusing him of casting those demons out by the power of Beelzebul, the prince of the demons. And Jesus really just uses some simple logic there to say, that doesn't even really make sense. He says, if Satan is divided against himself, then how will his kingdom stand? It would be self-defeating for Satan to give Jesus the power to cast out demons. But this is what he says starting in verse 20. He says, "But if it is by the finger of God that I cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. When a strong man, fully armed, guards his own palace, his goods are safe. But when one stronger than he attacks him and overcomes him, he takes away his armor in which he trusted and divides his spoil. Whoever is not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters. Now I want you to notice that Jesus describes Satan here as a strong man. And if you have ever lived under siege to the devil, you know that that's true. You know how strong a grip sin can have on your life and on your heart. You know how difficult it feels and impossible sometimes even to break free. But notice this. Jesus describes himself as one stronger than he. Stronger than he. As strong as Satan's grip might be on your heart, as strong as the captivity might be that you experience in sin, Jesus says that his strength is able to overcome that strength. And in fact, he speaks of it as if it's already been done. Just like God overcame the Syrian army for Israel, took away their armor, divided their spoils, Jesus has done the same thing to the devil for us. And so that means that if you are living under siege to Satan, you're actually free to leave whenever you want to. It might feel like you're stepping out into the unknown. You might not really know what to expect if you leave your old life and your old ways behind. But the reality is, your captor has already been defeated. And when you are courageous enough to leave the captivity of the city, you'll find a feast that's prepared for you. And it's because the Lord himself has opened up windows in heaven to provide for us. Remember, that's what the captain said it would take for God to provide for Samaria and their siege. And that's exactly what God has done to provide for us in ours. God's own Son came down from heaven to die for us and set us free. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 8 says, "The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil." And so our salvation has been accomplished by divine intervention. But in order to partake of it, we have to believe in him. Remember, that's why the captain saw the providence of God but did not eat of it. He didn't believe what the word of the Lord was. He didn't believe in what the Lord would do. And Jesus said that there would be some people like that today too. In John chapter 6 and verse 35, Jesus said to the crowd that he was speaking to, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you have seen me, and yet do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me I will never cast out. For I have come down from heaven, not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And this is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up on the last day. For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who looks on the Son and believes in him should have eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day." Now I know that Jesus is talking to people who are seeing him literally and physically, but there's a sense in which all of us have seen Jesus. In fact, we talked about it this morning in Bible class, how Peter talks about, though you have not seen him, you love him. But Paul actually says it a different way in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 1. When he talks to people who have never physically seen Jesus, he says, "It was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified." If you've heard the gospel of Jesus Christ preached, if you have heard the message of Jesus, then you have seen the providence of God. But Jesus wants you to know that it's not enough to just see it. It's not enough to just behold him. You must believe in him in order to partake of the blessings. And so the lepers knew that what they found was good. They knew that what they found was too good to just keep to themselves. Once they had feasted, they said to each other, "We're not doing right. People have to know about this." And so, if you are still living under siege to Satan today, I have a responsibility to tell you that there's good news. Jesus Christ appeared to destroy the works of the devil. He gave his life to drive our captor away. Because of him, we can feast on eternal life. And because he is the bread of life, all of the deepest desires of our souls can be fully satisfied in him. And when Jesus becomes the satisfaction of your soul, when he means to you what he should mean to you, then earthly treasure begins to lose its value. Satan's siege begins to weaken. The appeal of those kinds of things fades away. Earthly treasure loses its grip. When you know that you are totally loved and accepted and cared for by God, then you no longer need to find satisfaction in other people or other things. You become free to actually love people and serve people instead of simply using them or abusing them. And so instead of living the rest of this life in the shadow of hell, you can live in the light of heaven itself, knowing that when Christ returns and the windows of heaven are opened again, it will be for him to take you home. That's the message of the gospel. And that, I believe, are the lessons that we ought to take from God's providence to people living under siege in 2 Kings 6 and 7.